Welcome to Casterbus. This week, James is in the hot seat. He is chatting with Adrian Munsey, who is the director and writer of Wonderland, science fiction in the atomic age. This is kicking off this Thursday, April the 3rd, on Sky Arts. Recommend you check this out. We've been given preview tapes of this. It's a really good documentary series about the history of science fiction. And there's a lot to digest and take in there. James chatted with Adrian Munsey last week. If you were in our Patreon, you would have been able to view the interview. We actually recorded it over Zoom. And so we've got the video footage for you to view for free Patreon members. And we've also got the earlier edition of the podcast. This went out on Saturday audio on Patreon. Again, it's free. You get the episode that you're listening to now ad-free. You get it early and more often than not with extra content. Now, because we like you all a lot and we want to encourage you to join our Patreon, this is the full interview as heard in the Patreon edition. There's no difference whatsoever. In fact, you're getting the bonus because you got me talking at the beginning of the interview. Well, okay, it might be a bonus for my wife, but actually not even that. I digress. Here's James.
On the Casterbus podcast this week, we are thrilled to introduce the mastermind behind Sky Arts' new Wonderland science fiction in the atomic age that airs 8 p.m. on Thursday, the 3rd of April. Adrian Munsey, you are the producer, the director, the writer, and this is where it gets crazy, and not just the narrator, but you scored as well, didn't you?
Yes, I did, yes.
So this is
better late than never.
Oh, that's interesting. We'll get into that then. So, I mean, to start off, this is, as we say, it's a four-part series that looks at science fiction sort of coming out from the atomic age in the 20th century. I've watched the four parts, which was really great to see. The first question, I'm just going to leap into this, Adrian, well, there's two ways we could leap into this, but I think we'll go on the personal way because, I mean, you are so much a part of this series, and this isn't the first in the Wonderland series. It seems very much something very close to your heart, something that's very much you in this. Do you want to talk about your interest maybe first in the Wonderland series and what it is as a theme series, and then also in this specific one, the choice of doing science fiction?
Well, I'd made a lot of stories and films on writers for Sky Arts, which I'd actually done on spec, and luckily they bought them. And then they asked me if I wanted to do a series on something, and I did come up with this idea of Wonderland because I'd always been interested in children's literature, I suppose. And by that, I don't mean little children, though it includes that, but I mean Beatrix Potter and Arthur Ransome, the things I read when I was small a million years ago. And it sort of worked to my, I wouldn't know, call it amazement, but it just seemed to work, and it brought together a lot of things for me, and it was well viewed and people liked it. So I'm nearly 120 now, so it was a pleasure, and since then Sky has asked me to do several more.
So yeah, so you did the Golden Age of Children's Literature back in 22. Story of Christmas again in 22, is that right?
And yes,
you did Gothic in 23.
Yes,
and now we've arrived at the latest one in the Wonderland series, but not the last, which is science fiction in the atomic age. Is science fiction something which interests you as much as the children's literature? Are these things which are really into you, the Gothic and the Christmas? Are these you? Are these things that you really
like?
Yes,
I have the Gothic and the top science fiction were both suggested by Jack Oliver, who's the commissioner at Sky, and they corresponded, you know, almost by coincidence, the things I'd been interested in. Again, the science fiction takes me back sort of to childhood, where when, you know, I remember Quatermass and John Wyndham, and I remember the first Doctor Who, and I remember by accident being in the same restaurant as John Pertwee and thinking, my goodness, and I was only, you know, I was 7 or 8 or whatever I was. And it's these things stick with you. And obviously I lived through 2001 and Stanley Kubrick, all that succession of amazing imaginations. And more recently, the dystopic, the idea of where are we going, what's happening, that became almost enlivened the interest. And then I sort of interested in J.G. Ballard, inner or outer, what is this interest in space? And then I remember, again, when I was much younger, Kennedy's excitement about the new frontier and the moonshots. All of these things coalesced in a lifetime, I suppose, of not continuous interest, but it's been in the background. And this allowed me to focus on a lot of things.
Because when I was watching the first episode, which very much sort of speaks about the atomic age and that sort of rose out of the Second World War and its impact on culture, civilization, as well as obviously science fiction, I think for me, I remember when being in the 80s, I was constantly aware of that sort of threat. Did you feel that? I mean, it is mentioned in the documentary. Did you really feel that kind of palpable fear of the atomic age?
Yes, I think everybody did. Mm. I don't think I thought that anybody was going to drop the bomb on me, but I had an interest in aircraft and in ships. And you couldn't not be aware of the power of this. I don't know if I'd call it a threat. It is a cloud that hang, but not continuously. I don't feel that.
Do you feel that's changed then? I mean, I remember when I was a kid, and I'll be honest, I still get nightmares about sort of nuclear holocaust, which I had as a kid, which still I get today. And they are so real. I mean, they're the most real things. I kind of live the end, thanks to my brain, semi-regularly in my dream state. The impact of the atomic age has been, it's been tremendous.
Well, it's interesting you say the nuclear holocaust, because I was born in 1947. And so for me, the memory and pictures that you saw as a young child Second World War Holocaust was at least as vivid as the contemporary atomic threat. Mm. So I felt one was living between two worlds. And then I think it's important to stress there was a great optimism around as well. I think it'd be wrong to say that. I felt as a child I was optimistic.
Well, that's interesting. I suppose, again, it's a generational thing. In the 80s, I was kind of very much aware, and I think very much aware because, as you rightly sort of point out in the documentaries, is it becomes so embedded within how science fiction grows and considers the world as it's growing.
Well, it was the space thing, which was completely generative in the sense that it captured a prospect, which in retrospect, now I'm so old, you wonder, what was it? What, as J.G. Ballard kept asking, why space? Which space are you looking at? Which space are you interested in? But I think it also, in many ways, in the 1960s, it coincided with people's interest in inner space, and you know, from psychoanalysis to psychedelics. But so it was a rich time in many ways, more naive than the present.
That's interesting. Yeah, I suppose we do have quite a cynical present these days.
I wouldn't call it cynical. I think people are genuinely... depressed is an over-familiar word. I think there's a concern about the future, partly because the young have it much harder now. And there is a sense in which the prospects are, even though people's health throughout the world is better, there's far less hunger, all those factors are much smaller than when I was young. Mm. But for people living in the West, unlike China, where the people are optimistic, I think people are concerned about their individual futures, family futures. Can they have families? The birth rate's dropping.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because I remember I always used to say to people that for Western civilization, especially as a white man. 1998 was probably the peak time for civilization, where there was a lot of optimism at the back end of the 90s about where things were going. And then things shifted radically when we got to 2000.
Yes, I hadn't thought of it like that, and I can see what it is. For me, it's a kind of economic fact that the economic factors became, if not oppressive, they became much harder to deal with.
Yeah, and I think we'd also got to a point where there'd been sort of changes sort of locally with issues with the problems within Northern Ireland, and there were sort of changes within, obviously, with Russia and the wall, the Berlin Wall going. That there was a sense in the 90s, that, especially the back end, that, and this new internet thing, which seemed exciting and freeing, that there was a utopia up ahead, and then things shifted. Do you think there's... just generally, I was going to ask this at the end, but I suppose because you brought it up, it's kind of pertinent now, because they sort of say that, you know, satire is almost dead because reality has become too much of a satire in itself to actually parody. Is there ever a sort of sense of where science fiction can go when, as you say, when the science fiction starts to almost slow down, the sort of look to the future slows down and becomes so much more kind of embedded in the possible?
Well, it is embedded in the possible, though, curiously, people may feel a greater sense of personal impossibility than in the more naive period when we were interested in the moonshot and Bob Dylan was singing. Well, I'm sort of thinking about H.G. Wells, I told you so, you fools, that idea that there's something we're all missing. I mean, it's intriguing that... Elon Musk is a tremendous science fiction fan, and much of his thought, I understand, is influenced by Douglas Adams and others, which makes you wonder, and wonder is part of science fiction, but where does wonder go? Is wonder naive? Is wonder simplistic? What are the ambiguities? What are the sorrows hidden in the opportunity? That's what I've felt most about. Mm. When I was making the films, that you know, you watch something like The Road, or you listen to Paul Matt McCarthy, or read The Road. These are strikingly powerful images that are being created. Dystopics are a funny word, but you know, the idea of the world, even though it's continuing, it's something having ended. Mm. What is it? It's ended. Is it some symbolic ending, or is it real? And there seems to be some confusions about what's real and what's possible and what isn't real and what's inside and what's outside. I mean, it's interesting that opinion is so important to people now, whereas an opinion can be based on inadequate evidence or research. Whereas I think I think therefore I am, but actually, if you run up against a brick wall, that'll put pain to a bit of thinking. There's some subtleties of how do you approach what's happening to us all.
And it's funny how science fiction becomes that space where it, even though it's often politically driven in its creation, in its consumption, politics doesn't seem to be so much of a thing. People from different political ideologies seem to mine different things out of the same pot. Starship Troopers is a good example of that. Even Star Trek.
You're onto something there, and also the three body problem coming out of China, and of course the idea that you can't map three different points, whereas algebra or geometry can map two points, but three is not mathematically mappable because there's just too many variables. And I think that's in a way what the science fiction interest has understood, and so it allows things still to be possible because there's some notion of what isn't possible.
Did you find, I don't mean this to be a personal question, but I was just thinking back to the recent pandemic, and that was the one time in my lifetime where suddenly the world did seem to change. And some would say maybe in a sci-fi sort of way, but I mean, as an someone interested in the genre and as a person living through it, how did you find that? Did it feel sort of almost like living in a sort of a terrible sci-fi space?
What I most wondered, I wondered all the time why people were so afraid of dying. I just couldn't understand, because there are so many things that can kill you. And I felt that, and I thought, again, the young had pretty hard time in the pandemic. Mm. And I was intrigued that the fear of loss of life had seemed to me to be sometimes by people who weren't at much risk, seemed to be a very powerful force in how they behaved. So, oddly, filmmaking was an occupation you were allowed to do. And so I was in this happy position that I could keep working. And the studios were empty, apart from a few people. Documentaries, you see, were allowed to be continued to be made. And it was an interesting time to be on the road.
So just thinking about the sort of documentary and your very long experience of working with documentaries, how different is it working on a documentary where there's a little bit of a passion project in it? Or do you find most of the documentaries you do you find that passion in the subject?
Well, it's a terrible thing to say, really, but I've only done them if I really wanted to do them. I mean, I've had another life. I was an academic for a period, and I ran some companies and I ran some television channels. I've had sort of a mixture of lives, and it wasn't until I was actually over 70 that I started directing films again. Whereas the previous time, I think I'd been 24. I'd produced quite a lot, and I went to film school after university, but I had this, you know, I was a producer rather than a director, and I suddenly woke up when I was getting on a bit.
And as you say, you've spread your wings quite considerably. I mean, especially as you say you haven't said yet, but I'm going to make you say, as a composer and musician, I mean, that's incredibly unusual to be bringing your own work to a television project like this. How was that?
Well, It, for some extraordinary reason, it happened when I was. I only really started writing directly. I'd used in the past my music that I'd done before, but on these Wonderland films, and I really did have written these for the programs, and a lot of it, some on orchestra with orchestra, some on synth, some with small groups, small musicians, and I was amazed. Suddenly, that it allowed a sort of background there. I always wanted the program to speak to people almost individually. Almost that there was a real connect. You allowed a connection to be made, and I found the music helped the speakers. You know, what we call the talking heads, to seem closer to me and to the audience. The music took away a distance.
Did your time as an academic, because you do have certainly two mainstay academics through the series, did that interest or that engagement and having that sort of critical eye come from your background?
Well, it's interesting that I almost think one probably wanted a second education. So I mean, I've always read a lot, but then so I really asked people I'd read if they'd be in the programs, and most of them said yes. And I was very impressed with the education they gave me. I found it thrilling, and as I found much of their work thrilling. And I would stress that all the people who I've been able to meet through making these films, I really feel the world is full of a very accessible knowledge.
Are you someone who looks to score when you see science fiction? Is the score music a part of your pleasure in watching the genre?
Well, you've got some pretty good people writing music, to say the least. You know, you run through who's done everything from 2001 onwards, Christopher. Really, you've got the finest music composers, past, present and future. So at first, I'm glad if you think my music worked on the films. I'm pleased because, you know, I'm in good company.
No, it was, yeah, it worked. It worked really well. It sort of kept me embedded. And when I was watching it, I wasn't aware that you actually had a hand in it. So I think that made it kind of cool as well. So if people listening to this watch the shows on Sky Arts, it'll be interesting to sort of experience it now, knowing that there's so much craft of you in there.
Stanley Kubrick used to say the music is half the film, half what makes it. I think Steven Spielberg feels the same. And what you don't want is it to be intrusive. You want it to be a support.
Absolutely. I mean, as you say, with a film background, and so that sort of auteur theory, all these great auteurs tend to stick with very, you know, with mainstay composers. It's clearly very much a part of their character of their films.
Well, I found the Kubrick, to have a look at Stanley Kubrick was wonderful, and to discover Failsafe in the film, which I'm told that George Clooney has seen 105 times and has remade Failsafe, though we stuck with the Sidney Lumet version. But it's Failsafe in episode one is an extraordinary film. And it was made before Dr. Strangelove, but Columbia bought Failsafe because they realized that they had to get Dr. Strangelove out first because you couldn't have a comedy after a so-called, you know, doco type feature. Mm.
Yeah. So is there any of those composers, is there one that you are particularly partial to?
Well, that's a very good question. My favourite is a French composer called Georges de Leroux, who I don't think has done any science fiction. But you've got some pretty amazing people working in with, you know, big, you know, the Christopher Nolan, who he works with. Those musical scores are big.
Hans Zimmer. I think it's Hans Zimmer, isn't it? He uses a lot of, yes, yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, you don't get better than that, really.
Yeah, he's an incredible composer. A lot of, even on his, the non-science fiction stuff like Dunkirk is incredibly jarring and soundtrack, which does that mixture, as you say, that sits in the film that you're not kind of aware of it, but you are kind of aware of it. So do you ever see a difference? Because, I mean, a lot of what you're talking in not totally, but there's a lot about science fiction. And sometimes people like to branch that out into sort of like a subgenre of science fantasy, where I suppose you've got things like Star Wars and maybe Doctor Who.
Well, you see, you're on. It's very interesting what you're talking about now. I got very interested in the hero myth that underpinned Star Wars and 2001. They'd both read a book about myth. Mm. And so it has sort of, you know, Jungian and Freudian themes. And the same with Ridley Scott in Blade Runner. You've got this interesting notions of, within science fiction, it does seem that many writers believe the hero would not fail, whereas in classical tragedy the hero always fails, and in if you follow psychoanalytic interpretation, it is almost bound to fail, even though a few may succeed. Mm. Whereas science fiction seems to have much of it in that great golden period, I suppose you might call it. The heroes succeeded. Mm. Now, in the 21st century, we're more pessimistic, and so these partial end of the world descriptions suggest that the world's people's quest, which was heroic, has failed, and that they're facing, if not extinction, major problems.
Do you think, because you speak about in the documentaries about science fiction being predominantly quite a male-written genre for a long time, is like that post-apocalyptic scenario something which kind of almost appeals to men, perhaps more than women? Is there sort of like a feeling of freedom, the freedom of the chains of society there?
Well, I don't. I mean, we in the third episode, we'd really have a look at the influence of Ursula Le Guin and other the real changes and notions, challenges really to those male hero myths, and that's an interesting set of things to have a look at. And I'm not going to have much of an opinion about that, but I think it's fascinating to see these ebbs and flows of what myths do predominate. And then you could argue the dystopian notion is another myth that in the end people muddle through. We certainly hope anyway.
Yes, that's a dark point. Are there any sort of more recent films that in science fiction that sort of have captured you in a different way? I mean, as you say, talking about this era, sort of breaking down some of what has become very much Campbell-esque.
Well, there's that wonderful French-Canadian director, and I'm going to forget the name of the film, which is just silly of me, about a language having to be decoded by a woman. And she, at the same time, has a child who she can foretell the future. She knows the future. And so she's asked questions, would she still do what she is doing and has done if you know the outcomes? And the same was, she had the same experience of decoding the language, and she decoded the language, and understanding something took away the threat, but not the loss of her child.
One thing I was interested in here was that you had the four parts to tell this story. And as you know, coming from academic roots, there's always that sense of people coming up with pitches for either academic work or, I suppose, intelligent film, which are far too big and would require multiple books or multiple. So this is a big subject, which you've managed to cram into four episodes, which is still, how did you decide how to play that story? How did you, where did you start off?
Well, with this film, I did start with the interviews, and I started with some questions I was asking people, and I'd read as widely as I could, and I'd seen as much as I could as well. And I had a, you know, you have a few hobby horses of your own, but in a way, that wasn't what motivated me. It was just because I actually didn't know enough when I started, it forced me to find out a lot. And after that became as kind of self-fulfilling. And what you do is endless re-edits. You partly on paper, and then on tape. I was going to say, on computer, and it's constant process of refining orders, narratives, juxtapositions. And I use illustration of key passages and comment on film descriptions, which of course is different from the literary description. So we have three things. We have the readings, we have the evocation of the readings, and we have a filmmaker's interpretation of some of the work. And then you have an academic discussion, and then you have some voice over in the film to try and integrate the things. You've got the chance of three or four different perspectives coinciding. And then you've got imagery, which is in the imaginations of science fiction writers operate at the very highest level. It goes beyond almost, it's a poetic imagination with a narrative to it. And so you've got some pretty good raw material, so it allows a freedom of visualization. That's what it did. The spatial scale of much of the imagination of the writers and filmmakers places you in a big world. And then, you know, I go back to J.G. Ballard with Crash or Atrocity or and this what's inside and what's outside. I was always, in a way, intrigued by that. How far outside do you go? Are you taken over by the outside? If I mean, is settlement of Mars really possible? And you know, the jury's out. Not for many people, but some, you know, the jury's out on really, people really did think these external worlds were going to become part of humankind. And it was as if it displaced, in the heroic period, notions of gender, race, migration, challenge. Now, if curiously, as the technology is at its height, the problems of living together on this Earth and living with our climate and our planet, I always felt that the preoccupation with the outside sometimes meant we'd forgotten how we'd mistreated what we were living on. And I sort of wondered, in a way, that if, you know, that the Earth Mother had been rather abused. And part of our fascination with other planets was an escape from our own, inverted commas, crimes or misabuses, or, you know, or misjudgments, whatever level of description you want to use. And I always felt that rather strongly. And that's why I found both Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, the older people, fascinating, because they brought up some of those themes, Captain Nemo, beneath the surface of the ocean. H.G. Wells predicting the Second World War, and being unable to, the shape of things to come. These are wonderful imaginations. And again, you know, when you're a child, and I'd never forget seeing 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and reading the book. They're just amazing. Well, you know, when you get to 120, still things have a great impact, but you're not quite inside them in the same way.
What was your feelings? I mean, we mentioned very briefly Doctor Who, and the podcast that we do tends to quite often center on that. Probably too much, really. Because my mum, I wasn't born when Doctor Who started. My mum always said it was like nothing she had seen before, almost like a Beatles moment in television. Right. What were your memories of that?
Well, I remember it as in a very black and white world. I was too frightened to watch Quatermass, so I hid behind the sofa when that was on. But I also was very... loved John Wyndham books and made sure that I didn't look at things in the sky for some time afterwards. So Doctor Who seemed to me to be part of that. And it seemed part of a post-war British thing as well. Yeah. I mean, that in the widest sense, British, that the retreat from empire, the whole re-rationing, the whole recreation of what Britain was. And so there was a hint in Doctor Who. I mean, who? It was asking the question. Was the television nation asking who they were? Quatermass also was about some technological failures that Britain had, though, of course, Britain had many technological successes, like Concorde, not like Blue Streak. So there was that. You know, many historians regard British technology now as having been underrated in that period, 1940 to 70. So the declinism view of Britain, in many respects, was wrong. That actually Britain kept going pretty well in the 60s and early 70s technologically. And then, well, we won't go into then what happened, because it will be here forever. But
it is funny how, when you talk about Britain, that Britain's science fiction never really sort of grasped that sort of Joseph Campbell that, as you talk about, and you talk about with Star Wars in the context of the in the TV show. Whether you look at Doctor Who, where essentially this character is reborn or dies and becomes another actor, or Blake Seven, which at the time was like a dystopian Star Trek, we've seemed to rejected that a bit, I think, have we?
Yes, well, you said something very intriguing, because it was interesting how the Americans really, really, really. You know, the hero myth in 2001 and Star Wars doesn't get bigger than that, does it? Whereas I think there's just the hint of an old airfield about the British versions and things possibly breaking down as well. But, you know,
But I mean, even going back to, as you were saying, with Elon Musk's favorite Douglas Adams, I mean, his stuff, you have a hero in a lot of his tales, but there's no sort of a sense of sort of lateral journey that you would get on in sort of American.
No, I think the British have a more questioning view about how likely you are going to be a hero. You may well fail. And the comedy, of course, which is an interesting part of the British, certainly within Quatermass and Doctor Who, there is, I wouldn't call it comedy, but there's a wonderful strain of take it from here about it, Journey into Space, which, of course, I probably should have covered that more, because Journey into Space, if you were alive in the 50s, was a big deal.
I wasn't alive in the 50s. Do you want to talk a little, just briefly, what Journey into Space was?
I was fortunate that I was given a radio when I was very small, and this became another world to me. And Journey into Space was one of the incredible Charles Chilton programmes that the BBC Home Service, as they say on Quatermass, used to play every week. And it was the most imaginative description of a journey to the moon, with airlocks, wonderful sound effects, and four incredible characters in it. And if you were a small child, as I was, it was the spirit of science fiction. And the Journey to Space was a BBC Radio 4 Charles Chilton Radiophonic Workshop creation. And it's still on Radio BBC 4 Extra. I think it was on last year.
You've had to be quite selective, and the literary roots of science fiction is very much what embeds itself throughout. And as we've seen recently with video games and all these sort of different genres, different ways of expressing science fiction, taking us in new directions, but the roots obviously being very much in the literary. I do find the British fascinating. I mean, I should say, I mean, I love Quatermass as well. I think especially Quatermass and The Pit especially has always been a favourite of mine. And the sort of British enemies in science fiction always tends to be the bureaucracy. It always tends to be the sort of slowness of way things go, or the way things are meant to go. It's like, no.
Well, they may be right.
So I thought it would be quite nice to just sort of wind things down, just to talk a little bit about the future for Wonderland, because as you're saying, you've got your next Wonderland project kind of have a sense might have interest to people who are into science fiction as well, because there is a little bit of an overlap in a way, oddly.
Yes, definitely espionage, intelligence, we have to call it as well, and secrets. The secrets is, there is a secret, many secrets revealed in science fiction, but the secrets are earthbound, geopolitical secrets in espionage. And of course, it will take you a different version of the Oedipal situation, arguably, that spying, what are you looking at? What are the earliest things people want to look at? And then there's the pragmatics of it. You need to know what everybody else is doing. And there are these wonderful Five Eyes, which is the intelligence network. And the whole idea of, it's a bleaker subject. Science fiction retains, I didn't think I'd feel this when I started, because I thought, what is this delusion about this space and all the rest of it? You know, I'm 120 and, wondering what's going on. But that, the more I explored it, the more I admired and the courage, really, of the imaginations and the humour. When obviously something like Stanley Kubrick, Peter Sellers playing five parts in Doctor Strangelove, and I think it's on the London stage at the moment. Mm-hmm. So these things don't go away. There's not that much humour in espionage.
What is espionage? Is that an interest of yours, or did you kind of approach with that sort of, as you said, that sort of semi-learned experience of science fiction?
Certainly become an interest of mine. I've met a number of people who with a lot of knowledge of espionage, and coincidentally, the death of Oleg Gordievsky a few days ago, we were interviewing a great friend of his, and the fact that nuclear war was the thing that he prevented by leaving Russia to tell Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, that they prolonged their nuclear testing war games, the Russians feared that there was the West was going to make a first strike, and so they were going to do their first strike first. So once you get interested in what is intelligence, how much is shared, how much is known, I find that challenging. And this whole question of trust, you see, is intelligence is based on trust, but you've got to know the other's secrets. These are interesting questions which we face at the moment. How yes. much intelligence can still be shared? Who's sharing it with who? And yes. to what ends? And you go back to these questions of geopolitics, ideologies, opinions, whose opinions? For whom? For what? So science fiction, because it's exploratory, that gives it a certain both innocence and knowledge at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think that's touching, actually. I found it very restorative to make the programs, rather like the children's one, that there was something, you can't, once you've got into it, you don't really want to leave it.
Mm. Yes, I can
see. There's some hope, isn't there? Even in the most pessimistic things, it's based on hope.
Yes. Yes, it's a weird sort of identification. It's almost a commentary on kind of like social, political issues of a time, which is trying to find an answer to in a way which is satisfying.
Yes.
And yes.
It is questing. It is questing.
Questing, yes, absolutely. That's a great word for it. Which is, again, as I say, I think something which comes across in the four episodes is that quest and kind of how the quest builds as people riff and work from, you know, people inspired by Kubrick, who are inspired by, you know, Lucas, inspired by many, many sources beyond. It's a
wonderful history. It's a wonderful yes. history to actually look, if you do ever look back on it, just... I'm really pleased that I was almost allowed to do this, because I would never have known. I wouldn't have known enough.
Is that in your mind the best way to do a documentary? Sort of go in not knowing. In theory, most documentaries should be to a degree.
A rather critical friend of mine says that I don't know what I'm doing till I do it, but I think that's probably. It's one way anyway. If you know what you're doing in advance, I'm not sure that doesn't always work.
No, absolutely. And to explore these sort of spaces with a fairly open mind, by the fact that you don't have the closed mind of knowing everything, I think adds to the journey that the audience takes, as well as taken on it.
The other thing, just going back to the music, was that I really did for this one, write a real theme for it, which is the guitar theme, which I used to... in fact, Duane Eddy only just died recently. But again, in the 60s, people like Duane Eddy, guitarist, his big hit was called Because They're Young. And in a way, that's the thing I felt about science fiction. There is something rather youthful about it. Even when it's written by elderly people.
Yeah, I suppose so, because I suppose in a way it's always pushing against what is considered, what is anticipated, and sort of and breaking a tradition, I suppose. The traditionality, as we get older, we become more formalized in our ways, and yet science fiction is always there trying to break them and go, but look at this, look what this might mean.
Well, there's not, yes. Even though the fear of the end of the world is there, there's a pretty full commitment to life, isn't there? So it's quite a big tension there. A good one.
Absolutely. And I won't give anything away, but I think the fourth episode kind of speaks a little to that, that it's not all about this the darkness of...
No. I'm just coming back to me that Adam Roberts at one point says, you know, that pessimism in a way is, and the evidence has recently been shown that older people are more pessimistic, and it's because of the fear of death, that's the fear of mortality. And that is one of the themes of the film, really, that there's hiding behind us all, there is this mortal, you know, there is this mortality. But the worst you hear, you may as well try and have a good go.
And watch some television, maybe. Oh, yes. Watch some television on the 3rd of April at 8 o'clock on Sky Arts, maybe. That might be a good space to watch some television. I'm sure, would you agree with that?
I'm hopeful. I do hope this has... I'm excited about this in a way that I mean, I'm always optimistic and hopeful, but there is something about this where if you're lucky, have one been able to touch something? I don't know. If I have, I'd be really pleased.
Well, I hope so too, because as I say, it's great when it's a piece of work which has such heavy creative involvement that you feel that there's a passion there, that this is, as much as obviously you've got a great crew working on this, that there's a very strong artistic steering throughout. I think that's always a cool thing. So if people are interested, this is the third time I've said it, but I think just in case you've got brains like mine which forget things, 8 p.m. on Thursday, 3rd of April. And it's Wonderland Science Fiction in the Atomic Age. And it's by Adrian and his production company, Odyssey Television. And I would certainly recommend giving it a watch. As I say, if you're into science fiction, this really does get into the nuts and bolts of it all.
Well, thank you very much for having me, James.
Thank you, Adrian. It's been great.